Welcome to Conversations on Buddha Nature, a project of the Tzadar Foundation associated with the Buddha Nature Resource website. So this is the first of a series of online interviews we will host with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature. For this event, Lopen Dr. Karma Punso will discuss themes of Buddha Nature, happiness, and altruism with world-renowned Buddhist monk, photographer, writer, and activist Matthew Ricard. Matthew has lived and worked in the Himalayan region for more than 40 years, having given up his scientific career in 1972 after completing a thesis in biochemistry at the Institut Pasteur. He is known for his amazing photography of the Himalayas and of Tibetan Buddhist peoples, as well as his speaking, writing, and translating. Lopen Dr. Karma Punso is the new recipient of Tzadar Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence Grant for Buddha Nature Studies, will be our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. Karma Punso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals and completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He is the founder and president of the Lodin Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist study circles around the world. So without further ado, please welcome Matthew Ricard joining us from France and Karma Punso joining us from Thimphu in Bhutan.
Metula, welcome to the Conversations on Buddha Nature. It's a great honor to have you with us. Through these conversations, we hope to develop a space for stimulating and inspiring exchanges of insights and experience on Buddha Nature and related subjects, while engaging in an exercise of right speech, mindful listening, and wholesome exploration of the purpose and meaning of life and existence. We hope to enhance the understanding and awareness of Buddha Nature and promote the ethos of innate goodness and positive perception as much as we can. This year has been particularly difficult for many people around the world. While some are going through a lot of stress and frustrations leading to low self-esteem, self-hatred, and depression, others have projected their frustrations onto other people through insular thinking, bigotry, and aggression. So at such times, it behooves us to look inward and reflect on our nature, which we believe is good and positive, the Buddha nature. So it's a great honor for us to have you here as our first guest for the conversation, since you have championed this message of inherent goodness, particularly in the Western world through your books and talks, and also through your compassionate activities. So I would like to begin with this question, Methula, of when did you and where did you actually first come across this concept of Buddha nature? Or where did you receive the teachings on Buddha nature? And what kind of first impression did it have on you? Can you recall anything outstanding, special?
Yes. So first of all, you know, I'm so glad to be here with all of you, all friends. And I want to express also my deep gratitude because there's been so many years now associated with the Tzadar Foundation. And on many aspects, all the books we printed in Nepal at Kensala Moshe's Monastery, the Rinchen Terzo, you know, so many volumes. And also the support for the translator, all that is so precious. So my first encounter with the Buddha nature, almost should say, when did I first forget the Buddha nature? Which is, I guess, when, you know, at the time, not me, but something happened that when the appearance from the primordial ground arose and there was some kind of switch that somehow the nature was not recognized and the whole samsara, and then we are here. But as an embodiment of the Buddha nature, I must say, without even knowing about the concept, when I met my first teacher, Kangyur Rinpoche, for me, now, then and now, is the closest thing that I can imagine about Buddha nature being appearing or being manifested in the human form, in sense of displaying what lies at the end of the path and what it looks like for a human being when all the whatever has to be dispelled in terms of darkness and obscuration has been dispelled, and whatever quality needs to be bloomed has been bloomed. But at that time, it was more like a source of inspiration. And my main practice was to try to mingle my little confused, narrow mind with this vast, compassionate, and wisdom mind. I have no idea about the formal practice, but spontaneously, the idea of mingling my mind with my teacher's mind, the Guru Yoga, and sort of resting in that, what seems to be merging with this immense awareness of his, sort of was, I think, for me, the quintessence and still the quintessence of all practices. And if you think about it, if you really can do that properly, this, you are bound to actualize the Buddha nature. And then later, after Kangyur Rinpoche passed away, I was greatly fortunate to be taken in hands by Dipo Kenzin Rinpoche, whom you met. I gave you a name, no? Is it? No, maybe not. I thought you met him when you were very young, no?
Yes, indeed, as a very young boy. I wouldn't say I really met him, but got teachings from him.
So then at that time, you know, I could speak Tibetan and receive this. And he was constantly all and on and on and on giving teachings of all kinds, sometimes to 10,000 people, sometimes to an old practitioner who came with a, you know, funky scarf to offer. And he would, in the same way, grant his teachings to anyone who would request. And since I was one of his attendants, so we will receive as well all those teachings. So then I start to, you know, more get an idea of the actual more content of the Buddhist teaching. And that notion, of course, came across in all the commentaries that Kenzin Rinpoche was explaining and the peak instruction he was giving. And I remember very well that you know, he was very often bringing that subject of the Buddha nature by referring to a quote from the Trantaparamita in 8,000 verse, which says, Sem Lamachi, Sem Kironshin Osawao. So Sem means the mind. And the mind here refers to the deluded mind, the mind which is confused, the mind that takes us to endlessly in samsara. And so to address that, the Buddha turned the first turning of the wheel with the Four Noble Truths. Then Sem Lamachi is the second turning of the wheel, which is about emptiness. So why did, according to Kenzin Rinpoche, why making the strong emphasis on emptiness first, in a way, before revealing or coming to the teaching on the qualities of the Buddha nature, which are inherent to that, to all sentient beings and to the Buddhahood? And Kenzin Rinpoche would say that it is because among the two extremes in which we can fall, either nihilism or sort of realism, or say naive materialism, which is to believe that all phenomena, solid existence, that there is a self that is autonomous, that is unitary, that is lasting, all that reification of the phenomenal world and the self is the, and the grasping we have to it is the major factor that keeps us in samsara. So that's the main thing that we begin, which we need to first to address. There is very little risk for ordinary beings to fall into nihilism. There's not a single ordinary being who thinks that nothing exists. So that danger is not there. So that's why we need that first very strong antidote before we can introduce the notion of the qualities of the Buddha nature, the qualities of the Dharmakaya, which are always there. Otherwise, if we introduce maybe too early, beginners might, we are still not free from those grasping to solidity of the true existence of phenomena, might grasp it as something again, some kind of entity, some kind of super Atman or something. So Kenzin Rinpoche used to give an example, which I think is found in the Yontenzu of Jimmy Limpa and the commentaries. It's like a mother with a newborn baby. And if the baby cannot digest the milk, and here the milk is the milk of the Buddha nature, of the luminosity and the clarity aspect, then the mother has to put some kind of very bitter substance on their breast so that the baby first does not drink the milk until he has cured from that. So that's why the emphasis is on emptiness. Then, of course, the same machi, the mind is devoid of true existence, it establishes the view of emptiness. The same kiranshin osarwao, then it shows the clarity, the knowing, the wisdom aspect, all the different qualities that emerge, that are co-emergent with the Buddha nature. And that's the third turning of the wheel of the Dharma, that's the 10 ultimate meaning sutra and so forth. So in that sense, that comes in due time with the three turning of the wheels. But of course, Kenzan Rinpoche would say, like in the same way that we say for the two truths, the relative truth and the absolute truth, likewise, emptiness and luminosity or clarity or the qualities of Buddha nature are not like two horns of a cow, two separate entities that somehow we go from one to the other. In order to fulfill that, the goal of turning the wheel of the Dharma, they have to be seen as united, of course, and indissociable. If you look at the emptiness aspect, there's the second turning of the wheel. If you look at the luminous aspect, that's the quality. So I think that's one of the things that Kenzan Rinpoche would constantly explain. And then also, he would often speak of Buddha nature in terms of the ground, the path, and the fruit. So the ground Buddha nature, according to the Nyingma view, we certainly all sentient beings have it like oil in any seed. So it is not like just a potential. I mean, it's completely, fully there and never changed. Nothing can improve it and nothing can degrade it. It's just the way things are. Now, the path is not to precisely fabricate perfection of the Buddha nature, because you cannot fabricate perfection. Fabrication comes in stages. It has different aspects. It is bound to be compounded, impermanent. So it doesn't fit with the Buddha nature. So the stages of the path, which has, of course, changing, which has steps and which are sort of changing, this. The veils that mask the Buddha nature and that we need to dispel to the different methods and stages of the path. And those are by nature impermanent, compounded, and do not belong to the Buddha nature. So finally, he would explain also the Buddha nature at the time of the fruit, which is not like a maturing the fruit itself, but simply the natural actualization and full manifestation of what was already there completely in the ground. So he would say that, and sometimes he would also relate to the first pronouncement of the Buddha, I have found it true, that is profound, that is luminous, that is beyond concept and uncompounded. And he would say that the Buddha could have stopped there, because the whole Buddha nature, the ultimate truth, the very goal of Buddha's teaching was there, but since being not able to understand that, so everything else, all the leading to the Buddha, to understanding that was taught by the Buddha. So in a way, that's how the Kenzan Rinpoche would teach. And then another way he would relate it to practice. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that after that.
Thank you. I mean, this is absolutely beautiful. I think you are conveying the meaning of Buddha nature from Kenzan Rinpoche in such a concise, but at the same time, deep way, bringing the luminosity that we find in the 8,000 verses of Perfection of Wisdom. I think we also have this description of Buddha nature as the luminous aspect of the mind in earlier sutras like the Anguttara Nikaya in the Theravada canon, but especially relating Buddha nature and its empty luminous nature to the different sets of teachings that the Buddha has given is really beautiful. And similarly with how it is connected to the ground path and the result. So Matthew, I have a question for you, which is more personal. Now in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you have these two approaches to Buddha nature. One tradition that likes to see Buddha nature as a seed, a potential that must be developed and cultivated. Like a seed of a tree blossoming into a tree, we need to develop this seed of the Buddha. But then you have the other tradition where the Buddha nature is seen as already perfect with all the qualities latent in it. And all we have to do is just reveal it. Which of these two thoughts appeal more to you and you use more in your practice?
Well, you know, whether they appeal or not, I think, you know, it's quite clear from what I mentioned about Kensei Rinpoche detailing the ground, path, and fruit aspects, that if it wasn't there absolutely fully and perfect, there's no way you can make it, because you can only make things, you know, bit by bit, and assembling things, and they will be bound to be fundamentally imperfect because they'll be compounded in permanence and all this, whatever comes with the relative phenomena. So there's no way that the Buddha nature can be fabricated in any way. So the only possibility is that it is the ground that is there and all the other things. What we have as a seed is what is a seed in us is the fact that we have not yet dispelled those different veils. So we have the potential for that, but this has not been done. So you can say to engage in the path, take refuge, generate the bodhicitta, receive the teachings of the three vehicles or the nine vehicles, communicating with the great perfection or Mahamudra and so forth, is like putting a seed and then you progress as you will till the ground and grow that seed. But what that seed will do and the fruit is the kind of that will bend the sickness of the obscurations. It does nothing to the Buddha nature. it cannot improve it, and it's never been degraded. And in a way, I think interestingly, besides the showing that it doesn't make sense otherwise, because you cannot fabricate perfection, there's also something relating to the teaching of the nature of mind. And I think if you think of the basic luminous quality of mind, just the basic awareness that is completely clear and yet has no mental construct, ideally. So that basic faculty, the luminous continuous mind, Nyukme Sem or whatever name you might give, that is, how can that ever be? There's no way that can be corrupted. It can be obscured, but it cannot be corrupted. Why? Because this is the most fundamental aspect of knowing, of mind, of awareness. So if you think of it, and to give an example, like a beam of light, a beam of light will light up many things, a heap of garbage or a heap of gold. But the light doesn't become dirty or doesn't become expensive. It's just the faculty to reveal all phenomena, outer phenomena, inner phenomena, or simply to rest in this state without mental fabrication. So by nature, light is not modified by what it lights up. In the same way, this basic nature of mind, which somehow is the luminous aspect of the Buddha nature, there's no way it can be altered, because its fundamental nature is just to know, to be aware. So in that sense, all you can do is to remove the obscurations. But that's, of course, the whole path is about that.
Mm-hmm. So removing obscurations, that's where I want to come and probably dig a little deeper into your own journey. You come from a very different cultural context than me, for instance. For somebody like myself, who is born in a culture rich in this kind of Buddhist thinking, Buddha nature is almost a given. Although later on, as a scholar, I did scrutinize the teachings on Buddha nature a bit. But it's far easier for us to get into these kind of notions. But for you, you came from a very secular background and a Western cultural context where there are philosophers and thinkers who influence in a big way, who present humanity as being basically evil and negative and not necessarily good. Thinkers like Friedrich Nietzsche, Freud, Schopenhauer, and then people in, especially in North America, Ayn Rand. You come from such a society, and then you move on to a concept like the Buddha nature, where everything is perfect primordially. How is that transition? And I'm sure there are lots of people who also make that kind of transition. What would be your experience in making that transition more smooth, or how do you deal with the tensions that you may face?
Well, you know, maybe because I'm just so dumb that I never even had a tension, intellectual tension, and I've never been a real scholar. So, but I think there was, that issue never came up in my mind. The reason is that for a long time, it was all about meeting the living example of what the Buddhahood could be as from whatever, you know, I cannot judge the inner realization of Kangyur Rinpoche, of the 16 Karmapa, of Dunjom Rinpoche, of, you know, Kensei Rinpoche, but everything we manage from them seems to be coherent with that idea of clearing all the shadows and making bloom all the quality that needs to bloom. So for many, many years, it was more like through being with such teachers that it was a kind of obvious thing. Then when in the beginning, even I remember Kangyur Rinpoche even discouraged me from learning Tibetan in the beginning. I mean, not in discourage, but he said, first practice, there's so many interesting things, you might get distracted. And after some years, he said, now maybe it's good to learn Tibetan and study, because it will help you to clarify doubts and go deeper, which was great. And then with Kensei Rinpoche, he was teaching nonstop. So then when, after having sort of being in the presence of these great masters, we exemplify whatever we ordinary beings can perceive of the Buddha nature in living form. When the teaching came, it was perfectly understandable and natural. And actually, it's much later when I sort of was dragged back in the West, 25 years after having left France for good, and I thought I'll never come back to this kind of activities. But somehow, because I did this book with my father, Jean-François Revel, the French philosopher, the monk and philosopher, I was dragged back on the scene. And suddenly, I was shocked almost to rediscover or more dig more into depth into those philosophers like Hobbes and others who thought that human nature is fundamentally, vitiated. Or even, early 20th century, the first half of the 20th century, all psychologists thought that basically we are damn selfish. And any seemingly altruistic behavior, if you scratch and look carefully and, with the right inquiring mind, you will find a selfish motive. They took that for granted. So I was shocked by that more than finding the teaching on the Buddha nature. And I thought, how is that possible to have such a, strange views? And so that's why, I started digging into that and spending 5 years of intense, work and research to research a book on altruism, because I thought, how can people doubt that, of course, we can be selfish, but also that genuine altruism does exist and it's so much more close to our fundamental nature.
Let me phrase that question again slightly differently. I mean, you were trained as a scientist. You worked in a famous science center under a Nobel laureate. And now you have also carried out quite a lot of psychological and scientific researches that are making inroads into meditation and so forth. But for lots of people, especially talking about, say, even young people here in the Himalayas, they take science as a fact. And then you have scientists like Richard Dawkins talking about the selfish gene. I think the scientific world seems to be divided on whether our biological makeup, our natural makeup is more selfish or selfless. Yes. And you are really arguing that it's selfless.
Well, of course, that's why I wrote a book of 800 pages to make the case. And, you know, people like Richard Dawkins, they are really in a way marginal, because a gene cannot be more selfish than a hammer or anything. No, a gene doesn't have no notion of selfishness or something. Anyway, this is just a catchy title, but it absolutely makes no sense. Anyway, precisely, you know, I thought it's obvious to me through, you know, being so many years with my teachers, that altruism does exist, that compassion is closer to our deepest nature. For instance, when we get very angry or a fit of anger and we do something that hurts others, we feel, there's even an expression, I was out of myself. You know, somehow we stepped out of what should be our basic nature. And then when we do an act of completely disinterested generosity, say you anonymously save the life of a child somewhere or make someone incredibly happy by fulfilling the aspiration, nobody knows about it, and you have such a satisfaction. And it feels that's so close to what your true nature. So this kind of adequation with the deepest part of yourself. And if you are a meditator, and also I'm not neither a scholar, but not a meditator, but when I try in my hermitage and for some days, I manage, you know, to be in a state of uniting with my teachers, wisdom mind, and watching the big space, and remaining in that, try to remain in state of awareness. The idea that out of that, hatred could arise as being hidden somewhere deep in my psyche looks absurd. From that state, it's like the light of the center of the sun. What emerges is only the light, only, you know, goodness, compassion, loving kindness. That's why.
Hello. Hello. I think I have lost connection with Matthew.
Products of so many mental constructs, like the clouds at the periphery that mask the sun from the outside but never touch the sun itself. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I mean, no, there's nothing wrong to be a scientist for that, because I feel that science is a rigorous investigation of reality. And we say that Buddhism, one of the main goals is to bridge the gap between appearance and reality. Appearance seems solid, truly existing, permanent, and so forth, and independent, and they are interdependent, you know, devoid of intrinsic existence and impermanent. So in a way, any rigorous knowledge is sort of scientific, and I never felt any difficulty to bridge my training as having a rigorous mind and what I discovered thanks to my teachers.
Thank you, Mithila. I think I lost you for a brief moment, so I don't know if I caught everything that you said. But one of the things that we today face all over the world is this kind of wicked world syndrome, a serious negativity bias. So how do we overcome such strong prejudice and bias, especially taking a more secular universal approach rather than, you know, going in a very narrow Buddhist way?
Yeah, that's very important. The wicked world syndrome is very simple, and it's related to the banality of goodness. I love this word. You know, Anna Arendt spoke of the banality of evil, speaking of Adolf Eichmann and some of the Nazis, because they seem to be ordinary people working in office and they commit the most terrible atrocities. But the banality of goodness is that most of the time, most of 7 billion human beings behave decently with each other. And we don't notice, because that's what is the baseline, that's what we are. When you come out of a train or a plane or a meeting hall, you don't congratulate yourself because people didn't kill each other on the plane. No, this is normal. If two people start fighting, you say, wow, two people start to fight in the plane, everybody will speak about that. If 100 people help some elderly somewhere, it won't be in the 8 o'clock TV news. If one of them attacks an old lady in the street, you sir, you have your hour of glory. So because it is deviant, we speak all the time, and because there's always something happening and the media like those things, we're attracted somehow because it's a potential danger. That's the wicked world syndrome. But scientifically, there's absolutely no base for this idea of universal selfishness. It's like what has been called armchair science. All the evidence, and the great psychologist friend of mine, Daniel Batson, spent 20 years with his team devising so many types of ingenious experimental setting to show that if you were giving the possibility of people to people to behave in a selfish way, having an easy escape and so forth, they'll get out of their way without reward, without being praised. I mean, I'll spare you the details. He spent 20, 30 years doing that to actually do something that they were motivated for the good of the person. So that's genuine altruism. And he said the selfish hypothesis so far doesn't stand to experiment. So that's very important, because in a way you could say that those basic good human qualities, fundamental human qualities that makes a good human being, that's the idea of secular ethics that Sonesh Dalai Lama is proposing. Basic fundamental human qualities out of which compassion and altruism are the most needed in our world. Those are much more attuned to our true nature. And we could say that somehow, to relate to our initial topic, they are sort of the glow of the Buddha nature. If the Buddha nature wasn't there, this would not happen. It's a little bit like, you know, you don't see the sun, but it still lights up the world through the clouds, even though you don't see the sun. So somehow it's the glow of it. And this is very interestingly shown in very young children, because you would say, you know, if as Freud was thinking that the little children are selfish brutes, but when they are 5 years old and they see how the social world, they see that it maybe is better to pretend to behave nicely that we can get along and fulfill our self-interest. So just more like a calculus than anything else. This has been shown to be completely wrong. All the studies done with very young infants from 1 to 4 years old, done by people like Warnecken and Tomasello at the Max Planck in Germany and other places, show that first they are unconditional cooperators. You know, if an experimenter drops something and is standing on the stool and the kids are playing in the room, even 2 years old, they stop playing and they come and pick it up to give it to that guy. So this is 90%. And now also young kids prefer people who behave nicely to each other, not to them. Now you show them two kinds of puppet. One puppet is trying to open a box, and the second one said the blue puppet comes and help to open the box. Then later on, the second puppet comes, the red puppet, and instead of helping, it sort of slammed back the box. Now, another experimenter showed those two puppets to the 1 year old toddlers. 95% pick up the nice one. So there's an innate propensity to appreciate goodness, to express goodness, to cooperate. So we can become psychopaths, commit mass murder, genocide. Yes, absolutely. But the predisposition is stronger towards pro-social behavior, towards kindness. And that's why we call it the basic goodness or the banality of goodness. And that's why we are shocked when something terrible happens. Otherwise, we will not speak about it. But because everyone speaks about it, then we think the world is bad, human nature is bad. Overexposure of the media, who shows only those things because somehow, you know, it's a potential danger. So we need to pay attention, but we don't pay attention to the goodness that is there.
Yeah. So when we look at this, you know, the kind of many sort of scientific experiments that you have been involved in, you have shared this a lot. I've actually attended a couple of sessions of your presentation on the impact of compassion and meditation on the brain and so forth. So if you put this in the context of Buddha nature, different aspects of Buddha nature, such as clarity or compassion, altruism, Is there possibility that we can enhance these qualities of Buddha nature without running through the traditional route of cultivating through meditation and practice? In other words, would there be some future sort of drugs or different ways of stimulating qualities?
Well, why going that way? I mean, no, you can do a lot of things in the brain with electrodes and drugs, but they don't replace training and practice. And I'll tell you why. For instance, when people have this epileptic fit, sometimes you need, if it is very serious, the neurosurgeon has to fit some electrodes in the brain. So for that, you do it when people are not sleeping, because you need to see their reaction. And anyway, the brain is insensitive. So you open the skull and then try to place it in the right place so that you can suppress the epileptic fit. But while they do so, sometimes they have a very strange, they put it somewhere else and there are very strange things happening. Some people see hallucination. They see their dog coming in the room. But some people, they get instantly depressed. All of a sudden, they say, what am I doing in this world? I'm totally useless. The world would be better without me. So what people who are about to commit suicide feel that they're extra in this world. There's no point living even 1 hour more. Just within seconds, you have induced that state artificially. Now you take this out, person comes back laughing, joyful, full of life. So there is a connection between the gross consciousness, of course, and the workings of the brain. And you can influence that. So you can give drugs that give you some sense of euphoria. You can give drugs that put you to sleep, all kinds of things. But that will not modify. That's just a shock momentary. Only thing that changes the brain through neuroplasticity that makes a structural change is when you are either exposed passively to new situation, say you change places, you live somewhere else with different people, or you are plunged into a war, whatever. And then your brain will change because your experience is changing a lot and over months. Or voluntarily by engaging in mind training. And as you know very well, my dear Karma, the word meditation means nothing by itself. It's just training. So if you say someone, I'm training, he will ask, what? Are you training, learning chess or playing football or lifting weights? And so meditation, training the mind in Sanskrit, bhavana means to cultivate. And gom in Tibetan, becoming familiar with. So you can become more familiar with focused attention. You can become more familiar with unconditional love and compassion. But you can also become more familiar with the workings of your mind. You can become more familiar trying to look at this pure awareness that is always there behind the screen of thought, but you don't see usually and you don't pay attention to it. It's like the blue sky that is behind so many clouds and 100,000s of birds that distract you, but the blue sky is always there, but you don't see it. So all that process of familiarization takes practice. No wonder when Gompopa asked to Milarepa, or Milarepa wanted to give a last teaching when parting from his disciple Gompopa, he called him back in the cave and licked his bottom and show how many callus he had on his butt, because he has been sitting on stone to practice. So practice is the only way. There's no such a magic bullet to cultivate those qualities. And again, cultivation means, again, removing slowly the veils that mask our true nature. We are not fabricating anything. We are revealing what is there, like cleaning the gold.
Matthew, I want to come back to your experience with your teachers. You have had this wonderful life working with great masters like Khandzu Rinpoche, Dewkhenzo Rinpoche, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Yoshike Rinpoche, and many others. But one of the things that you also did is you have worked on some historical masters, really outstanding masters, two of whom I've read the works you have done. Shapkar Sotu Rangdul, whose autobiography you have translated some 20 years ago or so. And then more recently, Zapatul Rinpoche, whose life and teachings you have recently published as The Enlightened Vagabond. So when you follow these past masters through their writings, what kind of experience do you get? Or another way of asking is, how do you feel being their voice, their voice for the contemporary audience? And how does it help your practice on Buddha nature?
Well, I'm not sure I'm a worthy representative of the physical grace being. As Shapka himself said about himself at the beginning, he feels like the telling his life story is like the donkey trying to run about those wonderful stallions that gallop ahead. So I think this was also inspired by my teachers. Kangyur Rinpoche used to tell a lot of stories about Patrul Rinpoche, and he was encouraging us to learn the Kunsan Lama Shilung, the words of my perfect teacher. That was one of the first things that we learned. And then on few occasions, Kenshin Rinpoche said that one of the most inspiring life story in Tibetan literature was that of Shapka, autobiography. And then our dear and regretted Jean Smith, also, which really I have so much admiration and love. He said also, you should read the life of Shapka. This is just amazing. So, and then when I started reading, this really should be available to practitioners. But that was my motivation. And about Patrul Rinpoche, I realized that there was two short biography. Actually, one was an expansion of the first one. Kenpo Kumpel was an slightly expanded version of Dodruk Tenpe Nima's, but only 20, 30 folios. While over so many years, 40 years, I heard so many stories. So I started writing them down. And then later, when I really felt that the tradition might disappear, the oral tradition, because I was hearing the same story after 20 years, and they will sort of get smaller and smaller and with less and less essence. But when I heard them from Kenshin Rinpoche, from Nyushiken Rinpoche, and other great masters in Tibet, so they were almost as if Patrul Rinpoche was there now, alive, and things were happening. They were telling them like almost, it was just 5 minutes ago. So I thought if I don't write down this will disappear. And so I collected over 100 stories, oral tradition from 18 different masters. Some of them were in such difficult dialect from Dachuka, I had to listen again and again with some friends. So anyway, I'm very glad that I could be instrumental and visiting the places and finding out descendant of his family and his last object, which Patrul Rinpoche used to have. So bringing that to life so that it stays with us as a source of inspiration. And for sure, Patrul Rinpoche and Shapka's life are extraordinary source of inspiration for practitioners, their teaching, the life example is the closest thing we can have to meeting them. So with Kenshin Rinpoche and Kangyur Rinpoche and the Karmapa and Dzogchen Rinpoche, we have also photographs, which for me is another way of, this is what they looked. Imagine you could see the face of Longchenpa or Jingme Limpa. That would be nice, no? Even though we can meet them to their writing even more, but somehow, their faces somehow express different facets of enlightenment. And they're all very different. Some are, skinny, some are very tall, like Kenshin Rinpoche, some are very skinny, like Karmapa Rinpoche. But there's a there's something that is similar in all the incredible quality that emanates from them, and that's an incredible source of inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on that note, I must say, I really want to also thank you for the anthology that you put together called On the Path to Enlightenment, Heart Advice from Great Tibetan Masters. It really is a great compilation of words of wisdom and instructions from so many different masters that you have collected over the years.
Well, that was also something, thanks to Kenshin Rinpoche, when he gave the Dangwa Zhe in 1981 in Punsolin, in Bhutan. I was serving him and preparing the books, and all throughout, at that time it was in 18 volumes. So throughout the initiations, every day I would prepare the book and so forth. So at the end, he gave me the collection that he had used, you know, the books themselves. And then he said, you know, it's only when you don't know what is in those collection, which is the eight chariots of accomplishment. So the four main and the Triga and so forth. He said, it's only when you don't know what's there that you can be sectarian. So, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to translate the whole thing. So many Lama Chilpas and Wong said, I cannot do that. But I made sort of the aspiration that if I could, you know, extract some of the heart advice, at least representative from each of the eight chariots. Of course, in the end, because I'm sort of biased, it was mostly from my teachers and mostly from Nyingma school and Kagyu school. But nevertheless, I made a point to have teachings from all and hard teachings and then try to put them as a private path. So it was the teaching who inspired me most, and it was also in sort of fulfillment of Kensei Rinpoche's words.
Well, with that, I think we can take the questions from the live audience. Online audience, I mean, if there are any questions. Marcus, are there any questions?
Yes, there are. Wonderful. Thank you both so much for this discussion. It's really inspiring, actually. I'm already happier since an hour ago. So we have a few questions coming in. One question here is, given these times, how do you feel is the best way to assist the modern world to clear the veils of the obscuring factors of their primordial Buddha nature without the in-depth practices of Munro, etc.?
Well, well, well. Should I reply or you want to reply, Karma?
I think you should respond to that, Mithu.
Okay. Well, there are two kinds of questions in that. I mean, two levels. One is purely Dharma. And I think clearly 100 times we need, I must emphasize because of what my teacher said, we need to definitely, you know, do all we can to practice the preliminaries. And some teacher think the main practice is profound. We think that the preliminaries are profound. And without that, then we risk to fall into people who have very high view and that cannot deal with daily life circumstances. I remember someone came to see Ramjan Boucher. He came from a center. He said, I'm only interested in great perfection. I don't want to hear anything else. Okay. And then he started complaining about everybody. You know, oh, those people are impossible and this and that. And Ramjan told him, but can't you practice a little bit longjong mind training? Oh, no, that's very difficult. So we thought, well, this guy can chew stones, he cannot chew butter. So that's why also all the great teachers said we must practice Mundo. And I remember one of the closest disciples of Digo Kensei Rinpoche, Sankara Rinpoche. He was a Drupa Kagyu Lama, but also very close student from Kensei Rinpoche, one of his best. Kensei thought he was, in terms of practice, perhaps he said once it was one of his really best students. So he did for 15 times the Hundred over 12 years. And once someone wanted to invite him to South America, our friend Geraldo, and he told him, maybe I should do a few more Hundred before traveling. So that shows, you know, and this was such a good example of a perfect practitioner. And now in terms of the trouble of the world, it's a completely different dimension. Then I think altruism is the only concept that can make us rise to the challenges of our times. And very, very briefly, I'll tell you why, if I may say, not again, I have a magic solution, but so many years of, you know, running around and meeting people from all walks of life. We have a problem reconciling three time scale, the short term needs. You know, the mother needs to feed her kids in Africa tomorrow, or the investors who play the stock market day after day and look at the balance sheet at the end of the month. So that's the short term. And then we have a very selfish economy, which, you know, what we see every day. And then there's the midterm, the quality of life, how we can flourish within a lifetime. And now there's a new dimension, is that the activity of human beings are vastly impacting the future suffering and happiness of others. 12,000 years ago, we were 5 million, now we are 7 billion, and we are the main factor. So selfishness will not do the job. If you maximize your personal interest now, it's just this selfish, you know, competition and so forth. So it will be poverty in the midst of plenty and damaging the planet and so forth. So if you want to sit around the table, have investors, social workers, politicians, scientists of the environment, and have one concept that can help us to build up a better world, the only one that works is having more consideration for others. If you do so, you will remedy to social injustice, you will remedy to poverty in the midst of plenty, you will have an economy that is based on solidarity, that is at the service of society. You will provide, like the GNH in Bhutan, Gross National Happiness, the condition for people to flourish. You will put that at the forefront. If a nation is the most powerful and the richest and everybody is unhappy, what's the point? So we must put the well-being of the citizen forefront. And then we must value the well-being of future generation and of 8 million other species who are populating this earth as our co-citizen. And I'll give you one number about that. We evaluate the number of Homo sapiens who ever lived on earth. It's not big. It's around 110 billion. Because again, 10,000 years ago, we were just a few million on earth. No big deal. So 110 or 20 billion, that's the number of animals that we kill every 2 months, every 2 months for our so-called needs. So that is a huge incoherence in our ethical system. So all that, only compassion and altruism can solve those issues. No other way. Selfishness will not do the job. You know, sometimes I joke that I'm a Marxist, but I'm the Groucho Marx tendency. Groucho Marx said, why should I care for future generation? What do they do for me? Well, unfortunately, that's what many politicians and, you know, people are telling now. They don't care about future generation. They don't care about the environment. So that's not acceptable. So that's why this is, you know, in line with the secular ethics of the Dalai Lama. This is in line that is our basic goodness. This is in line with our potential to do something. This is in line to enact compassion in action. So that's why we founded, you know, the very modest contribution, this association called Karuna Sechen in India, Nepal, and Tibet that now helps 350,000 people every year in the field of education, you know, health and social welfare. So we do what we can to alleviate the suffering of others, but that's a must. Compassion without action is sterile. Compassion without wisdom is blind, but if you don't do anything, then it's just words.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Matthew on this. I think Nyandro is a wonderful practice, a wonderful system for those who want to pursue a very serious dedicated Vajrayana practice, but I think in the real world, a lot of people are busy. They have their own priorities. So if one can't do a very systematic Nyandro practice, one could certainly focus on a specific practice and be an expert in that. And we have, for instance, I think if I remember correctly, when King Prasenjit approached the Buddha for a concise practice, the Buddha told him that as a king, he wouldn't have time for many things, but there's one thing he could do, and that's loving kindness. And we have—
yeah, there's always time for good heart. You know, as it's only a Solomon interpreter, you know, sometime at the end of a conference, he said, you know, I might have said something. If you think it's useful, use it, otherwise drop it. But one thing, please try to have a good heart. So that sounds very simple, maybe too simplistic, but in fact, that's all we need. Good heart, you know, laksam. And this leads to bodhicitta if we can, but at least don't harm. If you can do much good, don't harm, please.
Yes, a good heart that is also practically engaged and active. So I think, yes, as Matthew pointed out, engaged compassion is what the world calls for right now. Marcus, next please,
Yeah, so you've answered actually a number of the other questions already. You're covering things people are asking about really well. Here's a little shift, though, if you will, to philosophy. Someone is asking, Kunsong is asking, how can we reconcile the teachings on Buddha nature with the Prasangika Madhyamaka system? Very different kind of question.
Ooh. Well, I mean, again, this is really, I'm not an expert. I heard our friend Woolston did a wonderful lecture. So that's kind of the donkey is coming in. So I don't know, Kama, you want to say something? Well, basically, you know, I've received here in Dordogne for many years the explanation from Kenshin Pema Shelap. And, you know, I'm a very bad student, but it's kind of clear that this ultimate truth, how can it be different from, you know, somehow fundamentally different from the Buddha nature, that phenomena are devoid of intrinsic existence? Maybe the luminous aspect is not emphasized as much as in the third turning, but there's for sure no contradiction. And in a way, even when you practice the great perfection, we said you have to lay the foundation with the view of the Madhyamika. And then from that, all the unfolding through pure vision, through devotion, through seeing the ultimate nature of mind, the luminous aspects comes in of the Vajrayana teachings. But in no way you sort of part of the understanding of the Madhyamika, of course. And also, when Nipan Moshe said the ultimate description of reality is the union of emptiness and appearance, I mean, this perfectly resumes my very limited understanding. But, you know, karma has been done extensive study also with Kenshin Pema Shelap, I think. So after the donkey, yes, Let's see the stallion.
Not at all. I'm the donkey here. But I think Matthew and I, we approach this topic from the same sort of angle anyway, because of our close connections to people like Kenshin Pema Shelap and many other Nyingma masters. I did study in the Gelug tradition as well and have some Kagyu masters. But I think on the whole, among most of the great scholars and practitioners of Tibet, there's really no tension between Buddha nature and Prasangika Madhyamika. In fact, Buddha nature is both luminous and empty. There is that union of emptiness and appearance, which doesn't this go against the Prasangika Madhyamika tradition. There may have been Prasangika Madhyamika tradition scholars, masters of that tradition, who didn't accept an absolute Buddha nature. But I think on the whole, Prasangika Madhyamika tradition also accepts the luminosity of the mind, you know, when it comes to the nature of mind. And that luminosity is by nature also empty. So there's definitely no real tension, and particularly seeing it from the Nyingma perspective. And in fact, when you deal with Dzogchen, masters like Mipham would say that in order to master Dzogchen or Adi Yoga, you need to first master Prasangika Madhyamika. So they, in fact, are very closely linked instead of having any differences or tensions.
Yeah, and especially when Kenshin Pema Shelap taught extensively the Om Again commentary of Lama Mipham Rinpoche, and which was Woolston and translated as the ornament to the middle. I forgot exactly the title in English, the ornament to the middle way. So he really reconciled all the views of the practice, you know, being based on the mind only school that sees everything as display of the mind and the pure aspect, and the empty aspect has been the Prasangika, and reuniting all those different trends as non-contradictory. So, you know, so anyway, I cannot express it very quickly. Who then has many other commentaries, you know, and teachings on the nature of mind. So this is nothing contradictory. And so that's why it's so important to see the Buddha teachings as non-contradictory and all leading to the same goal and having ultimately the same intention, which come back to what I mentioned at the beginning of the first pronouncement of the Buddha. I found it true that is profound, luminous, uncompounded, and beyond concept. And that all leads to that, to different steps. You know, Kazumushi used to say in the beginning, you cannot give solid food to a newborn baby. And then later, as we our understanding and realization grow, then we can accept bigger views and more profound views, and have also an experiential, direct experience of what it all that means.
Mm. Could you maybe give some recommendations to everyone in terms of reading or anything you think that people could, you know, anything you would particularly recommend if people are interested in learning more about Buddha nature or what you've, anything you've talked about today?
I don't know. Well, specifically about Buddha nature, I mean, I think if you look at the whole crowded part of the Nyingma tradition as set in the Treasury of Precious Quality, of the commentary of Kanjo Rinpoche on Jingme Lingpa's Yonten Rinpoche Zhe. And for those who know Tibetan, there's a vast commentary of Kenpo Yonga, and two big volumes, and an auto-commentary by Jingme Lingpa himself. That leads you to a clear understanding step by step through all that. And there's a chapter on the perfection of wisdom, distinguishing all that, the expedient ultimate truth and the really ultimate truth. And then you move to the vision of the tantras and so forth. So that's the, probably the most way to make sense of the whole part. And then again, the commentary of the Umagyen, of the ornament to the middle way of Gyalpo Rinpoche is incredibly clear. And the introduction of Wilson Fletcher also is really illuminating. Commentary on the ninth chapter of the Bodhisattva Avatara, again by Nipan Rinpoche, Kitaka is so special. So, and then on practice, there's so many wonderful, inspiring teachings, the flight of Garuda, of Shapskar, and all that. This is more on the practice side. And so I don't know, I'm lost of word to recommend something because it's so vast and so wonderful, and there's so many sources of inspiration. And it all depends on what is most needed for us at this point to progress a little more and open a few more doors to our understanding and practice.
Wonderful, thank
you.
Are there
more questions, Marcus?
I think that's probably enough questions for now, yeah? Do you have any more points or questions?
Yeah, I would like to ask one more question to Matthew. But I think to add a title to what the list that Matthew already gave, Beacon of Certainty, translation of Mipham's Nyeshe Rinpoche, is also one place where you can find the Buddha nature theory and the Prasangika Madhyamika being very nicely reconciled by Mipham. So with that, now I want to ask my final question to Matthew. So you have been exploring the inherent good of human nature for so many years. When you were a young person, I was reading your book and you mentioned that you didn't want to have a meaningless life. You were really strongly in pursuit of meaning. So looking back at your life, what was one thing that made, or few things that made your life very meaningful, and what's the plan you have for the rest of your life?
Yeah, many of my much older friends, many have passed away now, I used to be a very grumpy and unpleasant teenager. So I hope I got rid of some of it. I mean, frankly speaking, it's all due to the kindness of my teacher. Otherwise, I would be probably some kind of young arrogant, or not young anymore, but old arrogant, I don't know, intellectual or whatever. So it's all my teacher's kindness. And I feel so fortunate that I met Kanjo Rinpoche when I was 21. When I was 26, I sort of retired from my usual activities and spent so many years with my teachers. It's entirely thanks to them. And so I'm full of appreciation that I could spend this life, even though I'm a very lazy practitioner. But at least I'm so fortunate, and I congratulate myself every moment of that. And, you know, it's like we say, like, around the golden mountain, even all the crow, which are very dark feathers, but somehow when the sun shines on the golden mountain and it shines a little bit sort of on the wings of the crowd, so they look like there's something upon them. So anything slightly good in my life is thanks to my teacher. So it looks maybe over devotion sort of vocabulary, but what else can I say? That's the way I see it.
But you also in your book very clearly point out how happiness and well-being, compassion are contagious. So it's really your teachers who have infected you with this spirit of compassion and happiness. I mean, you are no more a grumpy person. Now yes, you are supposed to be the world's happiest man.
So. Well, that's the biggest joke ever. But anyway, this, again, you know, even in the Yuan Tenzi also, it says that have an ordinary log that fall in the sandalwood forest with the water that drops from the sandalwood will take a little bit of perfume. Well, that's again, just like that.
So let's hope that this conversation and the sight of you and listening to you would have helped spread also a little bit of that fragrance of Buddha nature, compassion, altruism, and happiness to everybody who took part. So thank you, Mathila, for coming.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Kama. So nice to see you again.
Yes, you, I think I first saw you in 1980s. Probably you're the first white Western monk I saw as a little boy in Bumthang when Kenzen Mutu was giving the kanjur there.
Oh, yes. Oh, so fortunate.
Now here I am. What a privilege to sort of sit across you virtually and have a conversation. And
we're still alive. That's a quick plus.
Thank you very much. And I think before we close, I'll probably ask everyone to sort of take a moment to dedicate our merits that through whatever good we have done and will do in the future, may all beings attain sukha, the state of lasting well-being and flourishing both health and spirit. And today is Medicine Buddha Day here in the Himalayan Buddhist world. So. As the pandemic wreaks havoc across the globe, may we also remember those who are affected and pray that they swiftly recover. Those who are sick, swiftly recover quickly or swiftly recover from the illness, and may every illness of the world never arise again. So thank you. And thank you, audience, for joining us from wherever you are. And don't forget to visit buddhanature.org and find out more on Buddha Nature. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Take care.
Thank you so much.